clans for Iwul, and more of Moorland and the Stent clan for Selfsul. We'd already reached an agreement with the Iwul Hetman, unbeknownst to Selfsul. Administrator Tuzer had identified the Iwul leader as the more gullible Hetman, and also dangled the possibility of adding half of Cadellium to Iwul control, but only if they were our ally. The Selfsul Hetman was less interested, evidently having no inherent desire to carve up neighboring clans. However, he saw his province enclosed by our navy on one side, our army that he couldn't defeat to his south, and the Iwulese to his west. We knew he appealed to the other clans for help and was refused. He decided he had no option but to agree to our terms. Akuyan's summary passed over the calamitous details for the Prethi clan. In the 2 years after crushing the Prethi, the Narthani undertook a massive settlement and development program. All living Prethi males who were part of the Prethi fighting forces or were deemed potentially part of any resistance were deported as slaves back to Narthon. More than 4,000 men between ages of 14 and 50. Another 12,000 clan non-combatants had died as collateral damage during the fighting or the following chaos. 10,000 more fled to other clan provinces, and 16,000 older men, women, and children were eventually shipped off to slave markets. The remaining 20,000 Prethi were spared for their specific skills after convincing their new Narthani masters that they had switched loyalties, or they were converted to slaves when they could fill specific needs on Cadellium. This later included 900 Prethi women taken as concubines by Narthani officers and officials or used to fill troop brothels. The Prethi, as a clan, ceased to exist. Narthani immigrants slid into existing farms, mines, fishing, and trade shops, then expanded the cultivated acreage and established new farms on lands the Cadelli had not yet developed. On the day of the present meeting to formally initiate Phase 3, the 6th anniversary of the first Narthani trading house establishment, there were 12,000 Narthani troops and 100,000 civilians on Cadellium. Of the civilians, two-thirds were Narthani officials, craftsmen, farmers, overseers, and their families. The other third were slaves, or indentured servants from conquered peoples within the Narthan Empire. Akuyan cleared his throat after concluding the history summary. Up to this point, we've scrupulously confined military action to the three original provinces. We now need to decide if it's time for that to change. He looked at each man in turn. You've all been asked to give a formal report on your areas of responsibility. Colonel Zalfa, start off with the status of our troops. Colonel Zalfa straightened in his chair. The newest troops are still getting their land legs back after the voyage from Narthan. Zalfa's tenor conveyed satisfaction, as did the smile on his dark, handsome face. It will take several 6 days before I can start whipping them into shape. He settled his tall frame back in the chair and ran a finger and thumb over his dashing mustache. As expected, these men include both new recruits and a fair number of trash and troublemakers that commanders in Narthan wanted to be rid of. Akuyan rubbed his chin as he listened. People often misjudge the 38-year-old Zalfa because of his impressive appearance. He was a gifted tactician, fearless but not reckless, and decisive at critical moments. For these reasons, Akuyan had chosen him as his second in command. How long will it take to train them? I plan on treating them as if they had no previous military training. It'll take most of a year before they'll be in decent shape for a campaign. Once ready, the new arrivals will be integrated into existing units. I believe mixing the new arrivals with troops who'd been on Cadellium for some time will make our units more uniform. Otherwise, we'd have two sets of units with different experiences and backgrounds.
Akuyan approved.
A sound plan.
Zalpha frowned.
Some of the officers who arrived with the new men are disgruntled about breaking up units organized in Narthon. According to my evaluation and how we all know these things work, some of these officers got their positions based either on their family status or on bribes. Most have little practical experience or ability.
Assessor Hizair leaned forward.
And you're satisfied with how those disgruntled officers are adjusting?
Zalpha smiled, his eyes expressionless.
The problems diminished after I demoted a more vocal officer down a rank and sent him to command a guard unit attached to improving the main road to Selfsul.
Hizair sighed. Please try not to alienate too many great families of Narthon, Colonel Zulfa.
Zulfa scowled.
You did agree with my action.
Oh, I did, but fortunately, the officer in question already had numerous official and unofficial marks against his record. However, actions such as you took might accumulate negative consequences. If possible, next time, please try to find other solutions for problematic officers.
They all knew his meaning. Find an assignment with maximum chances of death or disappearance. Preferably, to allow a plausible report on the individual's bravery and noble service to the Empire.
And our Cadellium allies?
Prompted Akuyan.
Zulfa shrugged.
Brave enough. And will be useful as buffers between us and the rest of the Cadelli when we start raids into neighboring provinces. And then later as light cavalry screens for our troops. The Iwilis continue to be more enthused about the Alliance and the Selfsilis. We'll need to stay aware that on occasion we may have to prod Selfsil and restrain Iwil.
But you believe we're on track?
Yes, General. If necessary, we should be ready to take the field in a year.
Although I'd prefer a few more months.
Akuyan turned to Administrator Tuzer.
And you believe the civilian area is also going according to plan?
The other man next to Zalpha and across from Akuyan was Nizam Tuzer, 54, the administrative overseer of the non-military population, which included the civilian Narthani transportees to Cadellium and native Cadelli. Tuzer's portfolio also included maintaining order, watching for dissidents, and counter-espionage. Tuzer dressed in his usual dapper manner, and while his graying mustache, baggy eyes, and verging on portly figure made him appear older, his energy was unmatched among the five, and his mind was encyclopedic about the 100,000 non-military Narthonian slaves on the island. The civil authority's voice was like mellow oil flowing over his vocal cords.
All aspects are satisfactory, General.
Within Predhi Province, our people have replaced most of the original Cadelli. Farms are producing well with new Narthani farmers and herders. As new settlers arrive, we're expanding total acreage under cultivation as fast as possible. The land here is among the most fertile I've ever seen. And we're more than self-sufficient, at least in grain and meat production. I project we can begin exporting back to Narthon this year.
Tuzer's animated eyes exuded pleasure at the last assessment. Until now, the ships from Narthon brought troops, settlers, food, and everything needed for an enterprise of this magnitude, then sailed home empty after delivering their cargoes. The ability to return laden with food and other products of the island will pay for the operation's expenses and reinforce the progress of the mission to higher authorities. As expected, setting up sufficient crafts and industry bases will take longer.
Tuzer ran a plump, manicured hand over his embroidered waistcoat. While we'll still need to import finished goods for a period of time, the situation will improve as we expand and bring in more of our people.
Akuyan shifted his weight in his chair.
And the Kadeli, those within the former Predi territory.
No problems there. I think we've eliminated any major potential resistance.
The few remaining Predi are well incorporated or subdued.
Duzer plucked at the skin fold under his chin and spoke next as if carefully crafting the words.
The only ongoing problem is converting the ex-Predi to worship Naath. There have been a number of minor incidents, but they've decreased once the Kadeli learned our low tolerance for disturbances.
Noticeably absent at the meeting was the mission's chief Naath prelate, Mamduk Balkan. Balkan's absence was mainly due to his lack of interest in administrative and military matters. Except when they interfered with converting the native Kadeli to the true religion, worshipping Naath, god of war and dominance. Although Balkan was not an acknowledged part of the Naarthani command and reporting structure, Akuyan was obliged to give the prelate reasonable respect, though he didn't have to invite him to every meeting. Akuyan publicly and privately assured Balkan that he understood the prelate's concerns, but it was Akuyan's higher duty not to permit fervent conversion efforts to interfere with political and military affairs. Those had first priority before universal worship of Naath was possible. Balkan had chafed, but acquiesced. Akuyan only confessed to his wife Rabia his desire that Balkan suffer some unfortunate fatal accident. Akuyan believed that among his subordinates, at least Zalfa and Hizer, had the same unspoken wish. However, thus far Balkan had not interfered enough to warrant such a calamity. At times, Akuyan wished the prelate would overstep.
Of course, conversion is a priority.
Tuzera vowed for formality.
And we cooperate with Prelate Balkan as much as possible.
Though none of the five men were devout followers of Naath or any other god, lip service was required.
Outside of Predi, it's as Zolfa says, from the military side. On one hand, the Iwalese will integrate the smoothest. Within another generation, two at the most, they'll quit thinking of themselves as Iwalese. To help that along, we've encouraged teaching Naarthani in their schools, arguing it will help them interact with our people. We know from experience that switching to our language as soon as possible is a key to assimilation. Once the entire island is under our control, we'll mandate all islanders learn Naarthani. For now, I believe we can be confident about the Iwalese. On the other hand, Selfsul is still problematic. I've seen no signs of active resistance, but there's no doubt they're warier than the Iwalese, at least as far as the leadership is concerned. The Iwalese Hetman is about as venal and dense as we could hope, but Hetman Langor of Selfsul is shrewd and sees the reality of making the best of a bad situation.
Zalfa leaned forward, his eyes on Tuzer.
But you still think the Selfsul situation is stable enough not to consider taking firmer steps before we advance to the next phase?
We've been through this before. Answered Akuyan before Tuzer could reply. While they may drag their asses, the Selfsulese haven't given us sufficient reason to act, particularly since we want to convince other clans not to resist. It's one thing to do what we did to the Predi clan when they openly attacked us. If we're too severe just because a clan isn't enthusiastic, it will only make the other clans more resistant and more likely to unite too soon. Something we definitely don't want.
Zalfa sat back.
I know.
I only bring it up because I'm looking at the military side of it. I'm still not comfortable with the local auxiliaries I'll need to include once we get to Phase 4.
Tuzer nodded.
I appreciate your concerns, and as the General says, we've been careful not to press the Selfsil and the I-Will too hard. Neither clan is happy with us stationing 1,000 strong, permanent Nathani garrisons in their provinces. Those garrisons cause the usual resentments, but much of that is ameliorated by our generous expenditures into the local economies. We've also restricted troop movements to minimize conflict, at least for now. Once we expand and control other provinces, we'll tighten control over the Selfsil and I-Will clans. I believe those clans' leaderships know we could interfere much more. For example, the Selfsilese may disapprove of our using Predi women in our troop brothels, but it serves as another warning of what can happen to our opponents. I'm just reiterating we need to keep a close eye on the Selfsilese and not depend on them too much yet, said Zalfa.
Duly noted, acknowledged Akuyan.
He turned to Admiral Culkin, seated on his left. The 52-year-old commander of Narthani naval forces in Cadellian waters had a constant twinkle in eyes set in a round, smooth-shaven face. Culkin's habitual cheerfulness contrasted with the more severe countenances of the other four men, and his casual demeanor belied his fierce dedication to the Empire. The Admiral was one of the few men to whom Akuyan showed his more whimsical side when they were alone, and the one who might be regarded as a friend, if Akuyan had had that luxury.
Admiral Culkin, we've read your report on naval readiness and scouting and mapping of the Cadellium coasts. To confirm, is it your assessment that we're ready to proceed?
Oh, we'll continue with those activities.
Culkin clasped his hands on the table.
Mainly refining our charts. We've still seen no sign of navies from other realms, and our ships and men are in good condition.
He smiled and rapped his chest lightly with a fist.
Our naval forces are ready to proceed.
Akuyan turned to his heir.
Assessor Hizer, any comments or observations?
The final man at the table had listened attentively to the discussion. At being addressed, he absent-mindedly rolled his shoulders in a manner reminiscent of a predator shifting weight, confident in itself. Sadiq Hizer was 50, of stocky frame and dressed in plain dark trousers, a shirt, and a light coat. He might pass for a well-dressed but common tradesman until he looked at you. Behind penetrating dark eyes resided a sharp intellect refined by years of experience and education beyond most Nathani. Hizer was an assessor, a member of a small corps of men who served as the direct eyes and ears of the Nathani leadership's highest levels. He had no formal authority, but instead was charged with providing two types of information: general advice, if solicited by the mission's leaders, and independent evaluations of the mission's progress and leadership.
I think you've covered all the necessary grounds, General. As we all know, there are always adjustments to any plan, though I'm satisfied everything is proceeding through the major milestones. I see no reason to hesitate in moving on to the next phase.
Thank you, Assessor. We appreciate your input.
Akuyan kept a smile off his face. While Akuyan and his heir had gone over the same material 2 days earlier, this was the official support statement for the benefit of the record and the other leaders. Assessors were often thought of as spies for the Narthani High Command, which they were. But one of Akuyan's talents was to meld assigned assessors into his overall leadership structure, even if informally. In his heir, Akuyan knew he was fortunate to be assigned an assessor with whom he worked well. He would never understand those commanders who resented the presence of the assessors and kept them at arm's length, not when it risked friction between the two, and that friction possibly affecting the assessor's reports. Also, you lost the ability and insights the better assessors could provide. The five men spent another hour discussing details of the current status of Phase 2. Then Akuyan spoke the words for which the previous hours had been a prelude. "I think we can all agree that we're established enough to move into Phase 3 against the other 18 clans. Any disagreements or qualifications?" They shook their heads, and all four leaned forward in their seats, eyes alert, anticipating the mission commander's next words. "Then, as of today, we'll begin Phase 3. Direct action against the other clans. The plan has three interconnected parts. First, the Iwalese and the Selfsalese will increase low-level forays into neighboring clan provinces, gradually ramping up into raids. Second, I will finalize our arrangement with the Baldorian mercenaries to carry out raids on coastal villages, abbeys, and other selected targets. These raids should create turmoil within the coastal clans and force them to concentrate their fighting men to protect their own coasts, as well as minimize their ability to aid other clans." His air's smile was that of a serpent. "These non-Narthani seaborne raiders will sow uncertainty and give us a degree of deniability." Kalkin laced his fingers, elbows on the table, and cautioned. "Yes, the Baldorians are notorious pirates and raiders, but it won't fool the bright Agadeli for long." Akuyan pursed his lips. "We don't require fooling all of them, or for too long. Just long enough to sow confusion and force them to focus on their own security and not on helping other clans, as we move into direct efforts to destabilize the clans and any existing allegiances. We'll attempt to provoke inherent Cadellian clan conflicts to stir up old resentments. The methods will vary, depending on the clan and circumstances, but include using bribes and veiled threats to be sure a clan fully understands the implications of being on the wrong side of the inevitable Narthani supremacy. We're following the basic strategy that has worked well for the Empire. When the time is right, we'll move to Phase 4 and commit our troops and compel either a centrally located clan or that clan and its allies to fight large-scale battles so we can deliver decisive defeats. At that point, we expect some of the clans to concede Empire control to Cadellium and ally with us. The remaining clans will then surrender or be systematically destroyed."
"Invasion on the cheap," Zulfa growled. "It would have been faster to bring in enough troops to crush them all in one season's campaign, then move on."
It was not the first time Zulfa had expressed this opinion. Akuyan nodded, keeping his tone even, hiding his impatience. This ground had been covered many times in many meetings. "Faster, yes, but not as efficient." His air drummed fingers on the tabletop and shifted his weight.
"We all know the arguments. High Command plans carefully. Though we're not averse to using overwhelming force, we can obtain our objectives at less cost if time is not a critical factor. Incorporating Cadellium is part of our long-term plans for expansion of the Empire. But with other ongoing conflicts bordering Narthon, our mission here is important, though not particularly urgent.
Efficiency is always an important factor," Akuyan reiterated. "The Empire's forces are engaged in many places worldwide, limiting the number of troops they can commit to Cadellium if it can be avoided. As Alpha has said, the new men assigned to us are not the best. Even the original units sent here had poor performance ratings. High Command didn't think first-line units would be needed." He smiled at Zulfa. "You did a good job of working those men into shape.
and I'm sure you'll do the same with the new arrivals.
Zalfa snorted.
It's unlikely they'll ever be more than mediocre. We wouldn't want to pit them against the real opponent.
Akuyan pushed aside his unused notes on their mission through Phase 2.
Even so, they only need to be good enough to handle the Kadeli.
Akuyan rubbed his cheek.
What we don't want is for the clans to retreat to the mountains. It would take years to root them out. If High Command's plan works, we'll get most of the Kadeli to either cooperate or surrender with a minimum amount of our resources expended. Taking over the Predi province as we did was necessary but wasteful.
He eyed Zalfa.
Too much was destroyed and too many clansmen killed. We want to preserve as much as possible as we incorporate the islanders in the Empire. Living people are more useful than dead or enslaved ones. If possible. The decision formally made, Akuyan ended the meeting with a final reiteration of assignments. He didn't believe a fundamental purpose could be drummed in too many times or subordinates reminded too often of their roles. The meeting also served to ensure that all of the senior commanders understood how their interrelated tasks fit together.
Let's keep our eyes on the details, gentlemen. Colonel Zulfa, the Iwalese and the Selfsalese are to slowly ratchet up their incursions into neighboring clan territories, but not so quickly as to cause the other clans to unite too soon. Keep on top of them, especially the Iwalese. Admiral Culkin will handle the Buldorians and work with Assessor Hizair on general intelligence, gathering and planning seaborne raids. Administrator Tuzer will also assist Assessor Hizair in overseeing our overtures to selected clans, directing intelligence gathering, maintaining existing agents within Cadellium, and recruiting more agents as needed. The summary complete, Akuyan ended the meeting. Gentlemen, we all know our assignments. Let's get to it and bring the entire island into the Empire.
Oaken Akuyan and wife. Busy day, Oaken.
Rabia Akuyan set a plate of food in front of her husband, then sat and picked up her fork.
I arranged for the children to spend the evening with Major Nubar's family. I thought it would be nice to eat alone, in case you wanted to talk. Just the two of us.
Thank you. Oaken smiled.
From the aromas when I walked in, I assume you cooked this evening. Another clue is the smudge of flour on your elbow.
Well, the servants never quite get the seasoning right for braised beef the way you like it. And as long as I was cooking, I figured I might as well bake fresh bread. Anyway, you know I like to lend a hand with preparing and serving the evening meal, and it's been a while since I had a chance. It reminds me of the importance of family, and that we're not so far above other Nathani.
He shook his head. And because you enjoy it?
And because I like it. Even if cooking and serving are low class, it's sometimes relaxing.
Rabia's impish grin always brought a catch to his throat. He chuckled and filled her cup with Melosian tea, then poured himself a goblet of imported wine.
Well, you certainly don't admit that to others.
That's between us. She sipped her drink. Just like you only show me you're not always the...
She lowered her voice and took on a dramatic tone.
Totally assured commander of men.
Rabia touched his hand tenderly. Oaken projected himself to others as confident and only allowed uncertainties to show with her, which was one of the reasons she loved him. She canted her head.
How did the meeting go today?
Good. He buttered a thick slice of bread. We all agreed that we're ready to move to the next phase.
He sopped up gravy with a wad of bread.
I'm relieved that none of the leaders brought up problems I hadn't thought of.
And you expected there was something you hadn't thought of?
Oaken grunted through a mouthful of beef and gravy, then swallowed.
Not really, he admitted. But you never know. And I try never to assume too much.
He was cutting another piece of meat when he stopped, set both hands on the table, and looked fondly at his wife.
Thank you for this evening, dearest. I'm forever glad I have you and our two youngest children with me on this Cadelia mission.
He set down his knife, took her right hand, and kissed her fingers. She felt a faint blush of pleasure at the gesture.
I'm glad, too. I'd have missed you terribly.
I know we've always accompanied you, but this was to be so far from home, and for so long, I wondered if this time might be different.
Oaken shook his head, released her hand, and resumed eating. It's not so far I wanted to be without you.
While some of the Narthani officers brought their wives, others left their families back in Narthon, or wherever in the empire they originated. Some looked at this as an opportunity to sample the local women, and they took concubines or slaves. Akuyan had never felt the urge. Rabia came from a prominent Narthani family. She had seen great promise in the young Narthani officer serving under her father. Her family had not been pleased with her intention to marry Akuyan. His being from a subjugated tribe, albeit 2 centuries earlier. Only dim records remained of his original people. So thoroughly had they been absorbed that his family never considered themselves anything but authentic Narthani. Rabia set down her cup and brushed back a strand of hair.
I know it's a relief for you to finally move forward. We've been here 2 years and we both would like to get back to Narthon.
It's coming, dearest. Another year, 2 at the most.
Oaken drank from his wine goblet, then sighed.
Besides the meeting with my staff, there was the usual endless paperwork. Annual evaluations of my immediate subordinates, and reviewing those of all the other officers. Then more paperwork and meeting with Touzer and the other civilian leaders to review settlement progress and future expansions. Then more paperwork for the quarterly report due to be sent to Narthon. It's still a month away, but I want it completed in a timely manner.
Rabia raised her napkin to hide a smile. Her husband's meticulous work habits, along with his native intelligence and force of personality, had been the 3 pillars that justified her evaluation of him those many years ago, as well as the basis of his fast rise in service to the Empire.
I'm sure you'll finish on time with your usual thoroughness, she gently remonstrated.
It had not only been his future potential that had attracted her, for theirs was a love match not usual in the upper reaches of Narthani society.
Oaken smiled fondly. Thank you, my dear, for the endorsement. I may include it in the report summary. The interchange was part of a routine evolved over their 27 years of marriage. Her hair showed gray strands, and the lines around her eyes had deepened with the years, but he still saw the young woman who once seemed out of reach to a junior officer. A beauty she might not be, but the lively eyes, the mischievous smile, when directed at him, and the trim figure, hadn't changed, in addition to the indescribable something that made them belong together. He had never been tempted by other women once he and Rabia wed. Narthani society mandated there be only one wife to avoid inheritance and dynastic conflicts that had been the bane of early Narthani history. Not that there was a prohibition against a man having multiple women in his household, but there was only one wife, and her children would inherit. Any other women in the household, be they free concubines or slaves, were subordinate to the wife. Promising children of other women were formally recognized as the wife's, and such children might inherit under some circumstances. In Akuyan's case, the issues never arose. Rabia satisfied all of his needs, emotional, political, and sexual, and she was cognizant of all 3 roles.
Narth forbid you mention a mere woman was consulted on anything of importance, she teased. It was another part of their interplay. Narthani society excluded women in any role outside the home. To her, it was a never-healing sore, and to him, a stupidity that lost valuable contributions from women such as his wife. Not that they voiced such opinions except to each other. Don't forget, you promised Lufta and Ozim you would be home tomorrow night for their 11th birthday. Okun and Rabia had decided that the fraternal twins were skilled riders and old enough to graduate from ponies to trained, docile horses for birthday presents. Ozim, the boy, had failed in his campaign to be allowed to choose his own horse, while Lufta was indifferent to horses and would be content with whatever her parents chose. Okun sighed. You're right. I had forgotten. Thank Narth you're here as my memory for such things. He smiled, taking years off his face. I promise, dearest. Home in time for the birthday dinner.
Oh, Okun, before I forget, the mail packet included letters from Bilfor and Morzak. They're on your desk.
Their two oldest sons were 25 and 23 years old. The twins had come much later, after he and his wife thought there would be no more children. Bilfor and Morzak were junior officers in the Narthani army and had families of their own. Bilfor, the oldest, was steady and thorough. Okuyan thought he would rise to be a respected major or colonel, but likely no higher. Morzak, however, seemed to have inherited the intellect and astuteness of his parents. Rabia suspected he was the brightest in the entire family, and Okun once told her he could see Morzak going far, possibly at least as high as his father. As for the twins, they were still too young to be sure, though Okun thought Ozim had potential, while Lufta's minds flittered in all directions. Half the time Okun thought she might turn into another version of her mother. The rest of the time he wondered if she would end up an empty-headed twit. Through the rest of the evening, Okun and Rabia talked of family, of matters weighty and trivial, and of whatever their futures might bring. Okun Okuyan finished eating, his belly full, a slight buzz from the wine, his eyes always coming back to Rabia. Life was good. He'd risen high and might go higher. The mission was progressing well, and he was more than pleased with his family. And then there was Rabia. Always Rabia. Life was good. Chapter 6 Acceptance Catharsis. Joe had no sense of time, only that days blurred together. He gained strength and needed less help getting to and from the dining hall and the boarding house. Finally, the day came when he no longer needed assistance and could walk the Abbey grounds. The staff acted friendly. At least he assumed and hoped so, since their speech remained unintelligible. He lived in a semi-mute world, seeing mouths move and hearing sounds, but not communicating. The pattern of his life was to wake, eat in the dining hall, walk the grounds, sit in his room, and fall asleep hours after dark. In his explorations of the Abbey grounds, he found places to avoid seeing another person. In the southeast corner of the Abbey complex, where a fruit orchard abutted the 8-foot main outer wall, sat an old wooden chair. He would lean the weathered back against the wall and face a mixed row of lemon and a local fruit tree, foilamen, he later learned, which produced plum-shaped yellow fruit evocative of tomatoes and almonds. Though the taste combination was foreign to his palate the first time they served slices at evening meal, he came to appreciate the subtleties of the flavor mix. On other days, he rested within formal gardens behind the cathedral.
Several acres of small trees, bushes, grassy plants, and flower beds, accessed by a maze of paths. A wicker bench sat tucked away on a short, seldom-used side loop off a wider path. It was there, on this day, he sat, contemplating his existence. The midday meal had been a combination of foods from both Earth and this planet. Wheat for the bread, a stew of beef. He had seen cattle grazing in pastures outside the complex walls, and a mixture of unrecognized vegetables. For dessert, he'd eaten foilamen, and a brown, banana-like fruit with purplish flesh that tasted of raspberry and licorice. That he could eat foods from plants and animal evolved on this planet told him the biochemistries of Earth and the local ecosystem were compatible, since he hadn't been poisoned and his strength improved daily. The local organic molecules, proteins, carbohydrates, fats, and DNAs, must have similar basic structures as those on Earth. He thought it ironic that, to one question posed by his planned presentation at the AAAS conference, alternatives to standard heterocyclic basis and DNA of exobiosystems, he now knew the answer. Earth's biochemistry was not unique. It was knowledge worthy of a Nobel Prize. Except he was the only human in existence, now or perhaps ever, to possess it. Even worse, he had no one to share it with. He and the knowledge were locked away as surely as if both served life sentences in solitary confinement. Gray clouds hid the sun, but an initial drizzle passed. Despite the cloak draped over his shoulders, he shivered in the chill air. The bench in the alcove allowed views of lovingly designed and tended pebble paths winding among a mélange of plants, perhaps a quarter of which he recognized or suspected of originating on Earth. The rest he assumed were indigenous. He studied the juxtaposition of striking foliage, bloom successions, and colors. Wherever his eyes turned, he saw variety. To the left grew a shrub covered in blue, bell-shaped flowers. To the right, yellow and red flowers rose from a bed of foot-high foliage. Across the path, a grass-like plant bore small white flowers on thin, nearly invisible stems. A breath of wind moved the grass, and the flowers seemed free-floating, dancing like a swarm of small white insects. Joe followed the undulating passage of a butterfly with yellow and black markings. It fluttered past and settled on the blue flowers, sucking nectar from a blossom. It looked like a tiger swallowtail, just like at home. For an instant, his imagination transported him back to Earth and let him pretend he was home. The butterfly veered away as dragonfly-like creatures appeared. Their red and green striped wings flashed iridescent in the sunlight as they settled on the flowers. One unfurled a proboscis and probed for nectar. Joe leaned closer and studied one of the strange insects. They had six wings, stood on four legs, and used two more appendages with small pincers to manipulate the flower petals. It was not a terrestrial life form. The illusion of being on Earth evaporated. He trembled, slumped, and covered his face with his hands. Tears ran through Joe's fingers. Lost, alone, and desolate, he rocked, shoulders jerking as he sobbed. The bench shifted, then moved again. Someone's leg and body brushed against him. An arm draped over Joe's back and a hand gripped his right shoulder. The warmth of the person's body seeped into his consciousness. The nearness of another human being, any human, anchored him. His sense of absolute loneliness faded, along with his sobs. A soft breeze caressed his face. Overhead birds twittered. And in the distance, a dog barked. murmurs of workers in the vegetable garden filtered through the trees. The even breathing of the person brought Joe calm. He drew a shuddering breath, his emotions spent. The tears and sobs simply stopped, as if a faucet had turned off. He still felt the loneliness, but not the same sense of despair as before.
I'm alive. I'll never see Earth again or any of the people I knew. Not my friends, family, Julie, our unborn child. I'll never know whether it was a boy or a girl, or if it even existed.
He closed his eyes and turned his face to the sun uncovering behind clouds. His skin warmed to the touch of brightness. And everything else he knew. Every little thing. No Giants games. His lips curled into a wry smile at the hint of humor seeping into his list of losses. No Call of Duty video game sessions with friends. No summer days in the California wine country. No grousing whether the Democrats were more venal than the Republicans. No more wondering why anyone would care about the Kardashian family. No M&Ms. No single large moon, instead of the two small ones he'd seen here. Or wondering why he liked some country and western music. It was all gone. He opened his eyes and stared across the garden. The soft wind dried the remaining tears on his cheeks. He looked at some bright sides. If Harley had told the truth, he'd be immune to everything on the planet. He'd never have a cold again or any other disease. Also no tooth decay, since it was caused by bacteria. Those had to be major pluses. Having cavities here had to be grim. No cancer. Fortunate, since there'd be no treatments. Harley also said his physiology would be more efficient. Whatever that meant, he had no idea, but hoped it was a good thing. He gazed at the garden now bathed in sunlight, the last clouds clearing and the sun warming the air. Once more the bench shifted and the person's hand still gripped his shoulder. He turned, expecting to see Fitham, the older, kindly brother, or perhaps the woman called Deera, or one of the others who helped care for him when he first arrived. Joe's eyes slowly traveled from a massive chest to a broad face. It was the hulk of a man Joe had seen working around the Abbey. He'd noticed the man on occasion, but he always seemed alone, as if the other staff avoided him. They had walked past each other once, the man never indicating that he noticed Joe, who was awed by the man's size. He was enormous, a good 6'7" or 8", and a solid 300 or more pounds of bone and muscle. A perpetual scowl framed his wild red hair and beard. But as Joe inspected the man's face, he realized the scowl was only an impression given by the prominent brows and lines in the weathered face. Joe was drawn deeper. The eyes. Were they filled with concern? And compassion? Joe smiled tentatively and nodded, patting one of the man's massive legs. Thank you. The man inclined his head, rose, and flipped his hand. He wants me to follow him? Rising unsteadily, Joe walked beside the man. Joe wasn't short, but he barely reached over the man's broad shoulders. They walked slowly, side by side, through the garden and into the rear of the dining hall, where staff members prepared for the evening meal. Joe stood in the entrance, confused. What was the man up to? The giant approached a middle-aged woman with flour smudges on her arms and spoke in a deep, rumbling voice. She glared at him and shook her head, barking something at him. He took it calmly and again spoke quietly. Still frowning, she glanced at Joe and back at the giant. She nodded, wiped her hands on an expansive apron, and strode away. Turning, the giant walked back to Joe and took his arm, leading him to a table outside. He sat and waved at an opposite bench. Overhanging vines festooned with red flowers brushed Joe's head as he sat, then studied the man. The woman reappeared and slapped down two large metal steins, spilling liquid on the rough wooden table. Joe jerked his arms away from the spill. Foam covered the contents of the stein, and a strong aroma of hops hit his nose. Beer? She clomped away, and his fingers curled around the stein. It was icy cold. How did they keep it so cold? Even a cellar would only keep it cool at best. He took a sample sip, and then a long draught, and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. It was beer, strong and good. He smiled at the giant and lifted his stein. To you, whoever you are, I needed this. Setting down his half-finished beer, the man mountain pointed at himself.
Garnagon.
He tapped his own chest.
Garnagon. Carnigan.
Carnigan poked Joe's chest with a large forefinger and said something.
Joseph, Joe responded. I'm Joseph.
Carnigan's lips formed over the name.
Joseph. Joseph.
Then quicker.
Joseph.
Close enough, Joe grinned.
It was the same with the hospital staff. They didn't seem to have the J sound, and they turned the middle S of Joseph into a Z. Joseph was as close as they could pronounce. Looks like he was Joseph now. Carnigan pointed to himself again.
Carnigan, Puvi.
Joe. Joseph, he bit his lip. Joseph.
Might as well get used to my new name.
Joseph Kolsko.
Joseph Kolsko. Joseph Kolsko.
Carnigan echoed with a broad smile. They quaffed the steins in amicable silence. Whether it was the alcohol, the catharsis of weeping, or the personal contact, Joseph didn't know. But he felt different. The loneliness remained, as did nagging thoughts about what he was supposed to do next. He relaxed, however, at least for the moment. The woman from the kitchen reappeared, checked the status of the steins, took them away, and returned minutes later with two more and a plate of bread and cheese. Joseph and Carnigan spent the rest of the afternoon at the table talking, neither having any idea what the other said, but it didn't seem to matter. Their occasional laughter drew puzzled attention from staff members. Finally, the light faded as the workday ended, and other staff members headed into the dining hall. Carnigan rose and motioned for Joseph to come. They walked in and sat together, eating in silence. Joseph didn't think he was hungry after the beers, bread, and cheeses, but he ate the meal without hesitation. He tried to ignore questioning stares and the conversation buzz aimed at the two of them. Joseph yawned and rose. He could have slept where he sat, head on the table. Carnigan also stood and walked with him to his room.
Thank you, Carnigan.
Joseph held out an open hand.
I know you don't understand anything I'm saying, but thank you.
Then it occurred to him that an offered hand could be an insult in this culture. Thankfully, Carnigan understood the gesture. Yosef's hand disappeared in Carnegie's massive paw. He had a brief scare that local customs might mandate a firm handshake, which, when delivered by Carnegie, might require last rites for his hand. Fortunately, the grip was just firm. With a final smile and nod, Carnegie walked away, and Yosef entered his room, lay on the bed, and fell asleep without undressing. Carnegie's debriefing. Though Sistian and Dira Bainham could have lived in generous quarters in the Abbey complex, they preferred a house a few hundred yards from the outer Abbey grounds. The distance allowed them time and space away from responsibilities and provided a normal family life for them and two children still living at home. As they walked home that evening, their shoes disturbed dust on the wide path, her skirt and his pants brushing against bordering grass. Dira linked her arm in Sistian's. "Brother Fithim called me to witness a rather strange thing today involving Yosef." Sistian glanced at her.
"Yosef? What did he do?"
She chuckled.
"It isn't what he did. Brother Fithim took me to the area behind the kitchen where I saw an amazing sight. Yosef and Carnegie were drinking beer while talking and laughing."
Sistian's eyebrows rose.
"Carnegie? Laughing?"
"Yes, laughing. Although I can't imagine at what, since he wouldn't understand Yosef. According to Brother Fithim, Yosef was sweeping in the main garden. Fithim was about to go to him when Carnegie stopped working and sat next to Yosef. Soon they were acting like old friends. Sister Molly Wynn was taken aback when Carnegie showed up at the dining hall and spoke to her. I think it flustered her so much she didn't even argue the way she usually does about a break in routine, at least not too much."
Sistian shook his head.
"Carnegie and Yosef? Who would have thought?"
"Maybe it's simply a matter of two lost souls finding each other at a chance moment."
Dira pressed a finger to her lips.
"Almost like God put them together to help them both."
"Whatever it was, it's good for them."
The abbot stroked his beard, then glanced at his wife.
"I think I'd like to hear Carnegie's view about what happened. Let's bring him in tomorrow morning."
Dira shook her head.
"You're assuming we can get more than two words out of him."
The next morning, the rising sun touched peaks of the western hills when the two Bainhams arrived at the abbey and went directly to the abbot's office. Sistian spoke to an aide, who then hurried off.
"Brother Aelburn will ask Carnegie to join us."
Sistian walked to his chair and sat. Dira moved beside him and laid a hand on his shoulder. She looked down and smiled.
"And am I correct that from Brother Elburn's face he was hesitant?"
Sistian sighed.
"Carnegie intimidates everyone. I've counseled him to be friendlier, but he looks at me like I'm speaking Narthani."
"I think it's also that he's had little experience with people being friendly to him."
Dira smoothed her dress's folds.
"He's certainly calmer than when he first came. But it's as if he's always sad. Like he's accepted the status of being apart from others, or perhaps resigned might be a better word."
A few minutes later, there was a knock. Brother Aelburn opened the door and stepped in.
"Abbess, Abbot, Brother Carnegie is here."
"Thank you, Aelburn," Dira said. "Please ask him to come in."
Aelburn stepped away and Carnegie filled the doorway. It wasn't a small doorway, but only narrow gaps separated the man and the door jams. Dira stared, folding her arms, tucking her hands into her sleeves.
There was the rumor that Carnegie had once killed a steer with a single blow. She'd always assumed it was one of those snide comments people made about someone different who made them uneasy. It was probably just a silly rumor. Probably. Carnegie stood motionless, his face stoic. If he was surprised at being asked to come to the abbot's office so early in the morning, he didn't show it. He and the abbot usually spoke once or twice a month. The abbot would inquire how Carnegie was doing and offer advice. Such counseling was not an option for Carnegie, as it was for other staff. But it would be more effective if it involved two-way conversations, which were seldom forthcoming. Carnegie's summons to the abbot's office was the second unusual event he'd experienced in 2 days. As he followed Brother Elburn, Carnegie reasoned the two events were connected. He didn't know why he had gone to the stranger he had heard other staff members talking about. He'd seen the man walking the grounds and sitting on benches as many staff visitors and Carnegie himself had similarly done. He had been on his hands and knees, weeding a flower bed, taking care his bulk didn't disturb the flowers. Halfway through the bed, he heard weeping on the other side of the bushes. He stopped weeding, rose to his knees, and listened. The sounds were a bone-deep, emotional pain. He stood and walked around the parallel path to a junction and to the sounds. It was the stranger, elbows on his thighs, body shaking, head bowed in his hands, tears running between his fingers. Carnegie had stood for several moments, first simply observing, inclined to return to weeding. Then he felt he should do something. He sat next to the man, moved closer, put an arm over the man's back, and gripped a shoulder, saying nothing but sensing the man needed someone there at the moment. "Thank you for coming, Carnegie," Deera said. "Please sit." She motioned to the sturdier of two empty chairs. Deera could see her husband hold his breath as the man eased himself down. The chair survived, although its strained joints audibly complained. She studied Carnegie's expressionless face. Whatever went on inside the big man's mind stayed there. As far as Deera and Sistian knew, there was no one Carnegie spoke with regularly on anything other than work assignments. Neither did he socialize with anyone at the Abbey or in Abbotsford. Several nights a week, Carnegie would walk to a pub in the village. No matter how busy the evening, he sat in a corner table alone, sipping steins of beer. He attended God's Day morning service every week. As far as she knew, that was the sum of Carnegie's life in his 2 years at the Abbey. Sistian steepled his fingers. "I understand you met Joseph yesterday." Carnegie grunted and gave a brief nod. "He was troubled and you sat with him." Another grunt.
"Perhaps you could tell us a little about what happened," Deera said gently as she sat in the other seat.
"He was just lost for the moment,"
Carnegie said in his deep, emotionless voice.
"Carnegie,"
Deera said, shifting forward in her seat, hands folded on her lap.
"We've worried about Joseph since he recovered from whatever happened to him. We can't communicate with him, and we're concerned about how to help him."
"He's fine."
So much for in-depth diagnoses. Deera pressed on.
"This could be important for Joseph, Carnegie. He was crying. Then later he seemed in a better mood."
"As I said," Carnegie rumbled, "he was lost for the moment. Once he stopped crying, he was fine."
Sistian rubbed his cheek.
"I think the beers may have helped there."
"Maybe," Deera said.
but it might have been just what it seemed. It's not unusual for someone who suffered a bad experience to get relief by crying. There has even been speculation in medical circles that crying is God's gift to help us overcome what might otherwise seem overwhelming.
Sistian's expression was one she recognized to signify his doubt, but she knew he would defer to her on this. While she might study people's behavior with more of a medical slant than his theological one, they both serve those in need.
Deira sat back and smoothed her tunic. Would it be acceptable if we asked you to keep an eye on Yosef for the next few 6 days? Don't press him if he wants to be alone, but be available for whatever contact he wants.
Of course, Abbas.
Carnegie said in a flat tone. And try not to let him drink too much, Carnegie, Deira added. If for no other reason, then he's still recovering. Remember, his capacity won't be the same as yours, even when he's fully recovered.
Carnegie frowned. It was the first expression Deira saw on his face. As if he was offended at the suggestion he might consume an inordinate amount of alcohol.
I'll see he doesn't drink too much.
Carnegie grated, then rose and left without a by your leave or dismissal.
Deira held her laughter until Carnegie left. Oh, Sistian, even those few words are more than I've heard from Carnegie the whole time he's been here.
Loquacious he's not, though I'm encouraged by even this little of what passes for a conversation with Carnegie. I think you're right. Maybe he and Yosef can somehow touch each other in ways the rest of us don't understand. I'll give extra prayers today for the two of them.
Deira tapped a finger against her cheek. That Yosef and Carnegie talked so long without knowing what each was saying makes me think Yosef is ready to start learning to speak Kadeli. I wouldn't rush him quite yet, but as soon as he's ready, we should encourage it. We'll never know more of who he is and how he got here until that happens. Whatever his story is, it's bound to be fascinating.
Chapter 7 Kadelium Life. Adjusting. Yosef awoke with sunlight flooding his bed through a window. He stretched his limbs and noticed he felt good. A warm lassitude faded as his surroundings jolted him fully awake, but he still felt more alive since waking on this planet. How many hours had he slept? 10, 12 hours? Hours? However they measured time here, the day was well along. His bladder's urgent signals interrupted his wondering about time. He pulled on clothes and hustled to the boarding house he had first thought of as an outhouse. The building was more formal than the classic shed with the crescent moon on the wooden door on Earth. This one was the size of a house, with common areas for washing, and two classes of closable compartments, one for showers and sponge baths, and another for the activities that gave the building its name. The facility was unisex, with the compartments providing privacy. He was consternated the first time he defecated by himself and intuited the purpose of baskets of moss-like material next to the hole in the floor. Then surprise and momentary embarrassment resulted when he exited his compartment at the same moment a woman entered a neighboring one. This morning, his bladder satisfied, his stomach announced food as the next priority. He had missed the morning meal.
So, what are the rules here? He spoke aloud to himself.
If you missed the mealtime, were you shit out of luck until the next one?
Only one way to find out. Go over to the dining hall and look hungry.
As he walked the gravel paths, he noticed he hustled as he had on the way to the boarding house.
That he could hustle was notable. Not running, or even what anyone would call quick, but with movements faster than days before. He lifted the latch on the dining hall main door, leaned in to open the door, and walked in. As expected, no one sat and ate at the tables. He stood for perhaps a minute, wondering what to do next, when a girl carrying a box came out of the kitchen area, saw him, and started jabbering. He assumed she said something notable like, "Dining hall is closed until midday meal," or, "You missed breakfast, dumbass," or some such. Of course, she could be reciting local poetry or asking him to come by her room this evening, and he wouldn't know the difference. After more vocalizations, the woman either recognized him as the strange man or got tired of getting no response. She huffed, set the box on one table, pulled out a chair at another table, and motioned for him to sit. He did, and she went into the kitchen area, returning with a bowl, a large slice of the standard heavy dark bread, and a steaming mug of something. He gave her his best smile. "Thank you." "Sorry I'm late." She scowled and stomped away. The bowl held a porridge resembling dark oatmeal, supplemented with small chunks that appeared to be nuts and berries. The bread was split down the middle with a hunk of yellowish cheese stuck in the crevice. The contents of the mug looked like coffee but smelled like moist earth. He had drunk the brownish liquid before, though didn't recall the taste. He sipped gingerly, blowing to cool off the surface. It definitely wasn't coffee and had a faint root beer flavor to go along with the pungent aroma. Probably some kind of extract from a local plant root. After another sip, his head cleared of sleep's residues, and he eyed the mug with respect. Maybe not from a bean like coffee, but whatever it came from, it must have similar alkaloids to caffeine by the way it hit him. The mug's contents, the bowls, and the bread and cheese disappeared, while he mused over the botanical origin of the drink. He took the empty dishes and the spoon to the kitchen door, called out hello, and the same young woman appeared. She took the dishes from him, he thanked her, and she jabbered back. He expected she said, "Okay, get out of here and stop bothering us." He somehow doubted it was, "You're more than welcome and come in any time for anything you want to eat. Also, probably not my room, 8 o'clock. Be there." He smiled, chuckled, and bustled out the main door. Josef learns Kadeli. Once outside, he stood in the light and felt warmth against his face. He looked up and, for the first time since his arrival, consciously noticed the sun. That he could look at the sun for a few seconds without having to avert his eyes was one more clue he wasn't on Earth. The orb was larger than Sol, and the color had more of an orange tint than the yellow of Earth's sun. If he remembered his astronomy, this must still be a Class G sun, like Sol, though a little smaller and cooler. It probably looked larger because this planet's orbit must be closer to its sun than Earth. Whatever the sun's characteristics, the colors he saw around him appeared normal. The sky was robin's egg blue, the nearby flowers red and yellow, the foliage a mix of familiar greens plus darker hues he assumed were native to this planet. He walked the paths of the formal garden behind the cathedral, his mind clearer than since arriving to this place. He'd shit and eaten. Normally he'd say he needed a shower and a shave to finish out the morning rituals, although perhaps in a different order. Shaving didn't seem to be in the cards here. Every man Josef had seen since he'd awakened here sported a beard. The length, shapes, and degree of grooming seemed left to individual preferences, and the only smooth-faced males were boys, still too young to have developed fuzz.
Even if he had a razor, to fit in, he would have to get accustomed to a beard. He had had one in college as an undergrad, back in his look-at-me-I'm-adult-and-an-intellectual phase. He hadn't cared much for the beard then, and the one he was currently growing felt scruffy after a couple of weeks' growth. He was just going to have to get used to it. As for the last of the four rituals, bathing remained. His nose had already noted that daily showers or baths were not the norm here. Although the BO levels were much higher than he was accustomed to, it surprised him it wasn't worse. Maybe it was the clothing, constructed from some natural fibers like wool, cotton, flax, or bandersnatchy. He already knew he got more odoriferous if wearing shirts made of synthetics compared to cotton. Still, it got pretty earthy at evening meal times when the dining hall fills with bodies who had been working all day. He sniffed his left armpit and grimaced. He needed a shower. But not now. Later, before evening meal. For now, he needed to think. He continued a slow walk around the gardens and the grounds. An occasional local passed him, giving what he assumed to be a greeting, although for all he knew, they were incantations to ward off the weird stranger who might be a demon. He only partly noticed them. He was deep into thoughts about where he was, how he got here, and most important, what was he going to do? The same thoughts dominated his mind all day and the next. He was here. Not wanting to be here was meaningless. He was here. Simply sleeping in the small room they provided. Eating three meals, shitting, and walking around, agonizing over what had happened wouldn't work. What was he actually going to do? The immediate answer was obvious. He didn't know. Though he didn't have a long-term plan, he needed to act on the proverbial advice, don't just stand there, do something. Since he didn't know what he was going to do long-term, at least he needed to do something, if only to get ready for when he did have a plan. He stopped in the middle of a garden path and spoke aloud, oblivious to his surroundings and an approaching man. Language. No question. It's the unavoidable priority. Nothing long-term is going to happen or be decided until I know enough of the language to communicate. The man passed, eyeing him carefully and stepping aside to avoid contact with the stranger conversing with the air. Yosef didn't notice. Yes. Language. That's what I have to do first. Having a clear, immediate goal both reassured and intimidated him. To know what he needed to do, even if short-term, was a rock to stand on. However, it could also be shifting sand. He had had 2 years each of Spanish in high school and German in college, the latter a chemistry degree requirement left over from the days when much of the world's best chemistry work was published in German. That those days were many decades past by the time he got to college was evidently irrelevant to the Berkeley chemistry department. Neither language stuck with him, leaving him enough to pronounce the menu items at a Mexican restaurant and stumble through German chemistry publications. This was going to be ugly and grueling, but he had no choice. He had to understand and speak the language. Having an action plan, he sought out Carnegie at the next morning's meal and found him eating by himself as usual. Yosef plopped himself down at the same table, facing Carnegie, who appeared a little taken aback at the effrontery of someone sitting with him until he recognized Yosef. The initial frown changed to a twinkle as Yosef started talking to him in English.
Well, Carnegie, congratulations on being appointed my first tutor in whatever you people call your language. Hope you appreciate the honor.
Carnegie grunted, his usual response to bursts of English, and continued eating. Yosef picked up the two-pronged local version of a fork, held it up with one hand,
pointed to the utensil with the other hand and said, "Fork. Fork. Fork."
Carnegie looked at him speculatively, then raised his eyebrows and said back,
"Sanctie. Sanctie. Sanctie."
They moved on from there. Head, eyes, hand, foot, chair, bowl, and knife. Once they finished eating and went outdoors, the lesson continued. Tree, sun, clouds, path, wood, rock, on and on. Yosef forgot many of the words immediately, but repetition encouraged him that the overall task wasn't hopeless. The lesson ended when Carnegie shook his head and made pushing and chopping motions with his arms.
"Work!
You're saying you need to get to work. Thanks, Carnegie, for picking up so quickly what I was trying to do." Yosef patted his shoulder and watched him turn and stride toward the barns. It was a start, but he needed to write down what he heard. He needed a pen and paper, or a quill and papyrus, or whatever the equivalent was here. Brother Fitham, he was the one to check with. It took an hour to find the elderly brother who had helped him in his first weeks. Fitham was hanging laundry on lines behind the guest quarters. After exchanging unintelligible comments to each other, Yosef mimed for writing materials. Later that evening, when Yosef got back to his room, on his table sat a stack of blank, pale brown paper, several sharpened quills, and a stoppered vial of ink. Thus began the first and certainly the only ever English dictionary to the local language. He wrote down everything he could remember from Carnegie, perhaps 20 nouns in English, and how he transcribed the equivalent local word. He grimaced at the results. It looked pathetic. "Oh, well, the longest trip starts with one step," he recited. The next morning, he brought paper, quill, and ink to the morning meal. Carnegie filled in nouns Yosef forgot from the day before, then left for work without further contribution to the dictionary. However, word had spread, whether by Carnegie, the abbot and the abbess, or the general observation the stranger was learning their language, and other staff took up the lessons. Whenever a staff member served a meal, he or she would point to each item and pronounce its name. When walking on the grounds, men and women pointed to buildings, doors, hose, rocks, on and on. As he passed people, they greeted him with phrases whose exact meaning he didn't understand but assumed were versions of hello, goodbye, good day, or whatever were common greetings. After a few hundred nouns, he moved on to verbs. By the end of the first 6 day, Abbot Sistian approached him with a boy about 13 years old. The boy carried several thin-bound books and additional writing materials. Sistian and Yosef managed to communicate enough for Yosef to understand the boy would provide lessons in the local language, both spoken and written. Thus began Yosef's serious study of Kadeli, as his young tutor gave him the name of the language and the people. He came to suspect Kadeli was an ancient ancestor of Indo-European, which, if correct, put the transplantation from Earth probably no later than 5,000 years B.C. As he had noticed while bedridden, about one word in three or four seemed related to one or more of the Earth languages he was familiar with. English, Spanish, and German. He remembered from an anthropology course that among diverse Indo-European languages, some of the most common and important words had similarities. Words such as mother, father, water, and occasional other nouns, although the similarities varied. While Kadeli words for mother and father sounded familiar, sister and brother didn't. The color blue sounded like blue, and red and black were familiar, but no other color sounded similar enough to stretch credulity of ancestry. Cold sounded like cold, but hot sounded closest to a local animal, and warm was a female body part whose specificity he didn't explore further. As his vocabulary and knowledge of Kadeli grammar increased, he learned details of his environment. The enclosed cluster of buildings he found himself in was a center of medicine, religion, and learning, and he conferred to the complex the title of Abbey, which he translated as making Sistian and Dira the abbot and the abbess, respectively. The abbey was formally named the Abbey of St. Sidran, commonly referred to as St. Sidran's, Sidran being the name of some past religious figure. The nearby town was Abersford, the province Keelan, the land a large island named Cadellium, and the planet was Anyar. From observing activity around the complex, Yosef had already figured out the cycle of days was by sixes, a six-day, 5 days of work and 1 day of rest and worship services in the large cathedral-like building. He learned the seasons, four, the months, nine, plus a 5 day start-of-year festival, and a thumb pointed upward from a fist meant the equivalent of a raised middle finger, and not approval. A good thing to know. Language by total immersion. His brain often felt fried by the end of a day spent memorizing words, practicing phrases and pronunciation, and a gradual increase in the morning reading-writing lesson with the boy assigned to him by the abbot from 2 to 4 hours each day. By the end of 2 6-days, Yosef had enough words to try asking questions and understand answers. He learned that his tutor was Selmar Bainham, the youngest son of Abbot Sistian and Abbess Dira Bainham. Another son, Cadwulf, was about 18 years old and studying at the abbey. There were also two Bainham daughters, older, married, and living with their families elsewhere. Selmar was diligent and tireless, so much so that several nights Yosef dreamed of being back in the 5th grade and drilled by a relentless Mrs. McMurdy.
God, what I wouldn't give to talk to someone in English for just a few minutes, he mumbled to himself after one language lesson on past and future tense. Someone other than myself.
He found himself singing softly just to hear the lyrics, which got him more than a few stares. Singing and humming to yourself seemed common here, but his tunes were not any the locals had ever heard. He got smiles at the obvious gaiety of Yellow Submarine, Jingle Bells, and I Get Around. More mixed looks accompanied hearing him whistling or singing Everything is Beautiful, Imagine, I Walk the Line, and various Bruce Springsteen numbers. He was surprised he could remember most of the lyrics to so many songs. Maybe whatever the Watchers did had improved his memory. An alternative explanation was more melancholy. Maybe the lack of English made his brain work harder to remember what it could before losing details of Earth forever. Chapter 8. Thorns. Even with Yosef's commitment to master Kadeli, there was a limit to what his brain would tolerate. As a counterbalance, a few days after he started language lessons, he began helping Carnegie in the big man's daily assignments. The weather was warm that day, with a breeze coming off the ocean and increasing cloud cover suggesting rain later in the day. He had been on one of his slow walks around the grounds after morning lessons and came upon Carnegie hoeing weeds in a vegetable field outside the complex's main wall.
Damn if this isn't a scene that might go viral on YouTube. The hoe looked like a toothpick when handled by someone who looked like he could carry a horse.
Yosef stood watching, then, without a conscious decision, went to his shed he had seen workers taking tools from and picked out another hoe. He went out to where Carnegie worked and started hoeing in the next row. Carnegie looked up from his work, nodded to Yosef, and went back to the weeds.
Josip kept up with the hoeing for almost an hour the first day before lagging. Even hoeing weeds was a major exertion, given his condition. When he had dropped several yards behind and audibly puffed, Carnegie took the hoe from his hands, turned him around, and pushed him gently but firmly toward the buildings. He rumbled something to Josip, who, without understanding a word, knew Carnegie said, "Nice work, but that's enough for today." On subsequent days, Josip met Carnegie either at morning meal or at the main abbey entrance and followed him to the day's assignment. Thus, Josip learned more than just weeding. Within a month, 6 6-days or 36 total days to a month by local custom, he experienced cleaning stables, brushing horses, milking cows, chasing ducks for the evening meal, pruning in the formal gardens and orchards, loading and unloading wagons, and, less to his liking, moving voiding vats to refuse pits, rinsing out the vats with buckets of water, and putting the vats back under the commode platforms of the voiding house. Fortunately, Carnegie's turn for that task came only once a month. Working with Carnegie gave Josef's brain a break, and his body strained with physical work unlike any previous experience. The rest of the hours into the evenings were absorbed with further language study. By the end of the first month, Josip had learned enough Gedeli to pick up stray pieces of conversations and even carry on limited exchanges. One morning, Carnegie came to the morning meal, but instead of his usual loose trousers and pullover shirt, he wore heavier, tighter clothing and an overvest of thick leather, like a version of a jerkin, a type of leather clothing worn on Earth in the 1500 to 1700s. Josip scanned the room. Several other men in the hall wore similar clothing. Josip mimed and used his limited Gedeli vocabulary to question the different dress. After several minutes of stumbling through words and gestures, Josip thought he understood Carnegie and other men would be gone for 2 6-days for some unclear obligation. After eating, Josip followed Carnegie and watched the men saddle horses and secure packs to other animals. By the time they left, the jerkins were added to with helmet-like protective headgear of thicker leather with inlaid metal bands. Aside from those general features, there was uniformity in neither their gear nor the weapons. Each man carried an assortment of swords, lances, muskets, pistols, and a few large crossbows. The number and array of weapons mesmerized Josip.
"Christ, man, what the fuck are you guys getting ready for?"
He had previously noticed men from the village carrying knives, yet nothing more deadly. Similar to clothing and weapons, the horses and the tack ranged in quality, sizes, and colors. Carnegie rode what resembled a grayish Percheron with a dark mane and tail, a horse suited to pulling large wagons or plows, or as a mount of a very large rider. Two huge flintlock pistols hung from Carnegie's saddle. He carried a lance, 2 feet longer than other men, and a battle axe hung across his back. Josip eyed the wicked-looking double blade. "My God," he thought. "That thing must have belonged to Paul Bunyan. I doubt I could swing it with both hands. But I'll bet Carnegie twirls it like a baton." Josip swallowed, and a taste of bile touched the back of his throat at an unbidden image of damage those blades could inflict. A grizzled man shouted to the others, and the men followed him out the main gate. Carnegie nodded in passing. Josip climbed a ladder to the rampart inside the complex main wall and watched the men ride toward the village a half mile away. Other single men in small groups joined them on the ride. By the time they reached Abersford, the group had grown to perhaps 20 riders. They disappeared into the village, then reappeared several minutes later, and 40 to 50 riders headed inland on the main road. Josip couldn't make out details, but they rode in a mass,
reminding him more of a Western movie posse than a military unit.
Well,
Yosef spoke aloud.
So things aren't all idyllic here. This isn't some Amish village. The people may live the simpler life, but something out there required guns and blades. Bandits? Rival clans? Predators? Whatever it is, it's serious.
When the last rider dipped behind a hill a mile away, Yosef climbed down from the rampart and walked back to the complex. Carnegie had indicated he would be gone 2 6-days, but it was 4 6-days before Yosef saw the big man again. Then, one morning, Carnegie and the other absent men sat at morning meal. Yosef didn't press where they had been as he sat and ate with Carnegie. He hadn't realized how much he'd missed the gruff man. Maybe it was only because Carnegie was the first person Yosef connected with, but even so, Yosef liked him. He might look menacing, and Yosef could believe it wouldn't be a person's smartest move to get on Carnegie's bad side. But there was more to him. And Yosef had a hunch Carnegie was brighter than he looked, yet with more common sense of the world smarts than book learning. He was also kinder than others might think. With the men back, Yosef returned to the routine of following Carnegie in his daily duties, yet Yosef's awareness had changed. Seeing Carnegie ride off with other men armed to the teeth, by the standards of this world, meant there were physical threats to warrant having armed groups of men. He'd been so focused on learning Kadeli and getting through each day that his universe was limited to his room and the Abbey complex. Obviously, there was more he needed to know to survive and build a life here. The recognition of dangers outside the Abbey walls brought back other questions that had temporarily retreated. Questions about the Watchers. Their unknown physical appearance was not as important a question as their intentions. Yosef inferred that the Watchers had been around this part of the galaxy for a long time, at least some thousands of years. He believed Harley when the voice said the Watchers didn't know who had transplanted humans, both here and on the other planets. Harley said there had been multiple translocations. Why had he ended up on Anyar? Simply a convenient place to dump him? Or was there some rationale? Why Kadelium? Was the island a deliberate or a random choice? Were there other survivors of the collision dumped on Anyar? He doubted he would ever know the answers. A more fundamental question, and one for which even the Watchers didn't have the answer, was why had that other alien race transplanted humans along with terrestrial plants and animals? Was it a benign act to let humans spread and evolve on more than one planet? A safety measure to assure humans survived in case something happened to their original planet? A malign act? A reason only understandable to an alien species? On one starry evening, he sat in the complex gardens and gazed at the stars with no constellations he recognized. He was likely the only human on Earth or Anyar who knew about the Watchers and the other human worlds, and there was nothing he could do with the information. He knew what would happen if in 1700 Earth he tried to describe television and aircraft. Depending on the country and perhaps even the locals, he could end up in an insane asylum or burned at the stake. So forget about telling anyone. Ever. It was knowledge he'd hold close and in isolation. That wasn't all he knew. Even if he couldn't share how he got here, he had scientific knowledge that would push Anyar civilizations ahead centuries.
But what to do with that knowledge? For 6 days, he thought about how he might introduce knowledge, or whether he dared at all. Chapter 9. Interview with the Abbot.
Joseph, wait a moment.
Joseph stopped and turned to face Brother Fitham. The kindly older brother smiled as he always did. Fitham laid an arthritic hand on Joseph's forearm.
Abbot Sistian requests you meet with him in his office tomorrow after morning meal.
Joseph's breath skipped at the words. He had been expecting this.
Did the abbot say what he wanted to meet about?
No, but I assume he's interested in how you're progressing. Joseph's gut tightened.
I'm sure. Tell the abbot I'll come as soon as I finish eating.
Fine, fine. Fitham patted him on the shoulder, turned, and retraced his steps.
So, it's that time. I've been wondering when the abbot would get around to this. I expected it to happen soon. The fact that I can carry on conversations with Brother Fitham is proof I'm ready to answer questions. The abbot has to be curious in the extreme about who the hell I am and how I got here. His manner is friendly enough, but this is likely to be a serious interrogation all the same. I'd better be on my toes.
He ambled back to his room as he reviewed the past months. The language studies had progressed faster than his initial concerns. Based on his experience with high school Spanish and chemical German, he was a sponge soaking up Cadelli. He knew part of the reason was total immersion. There was nothing to fall back on, to clarify uncertainties in lessons, to socialize, or to retreat into English. Cadelli was it, unless he wanted to talk to himself, which he often did. Even granted the incentives, the speed at which he went from stumbling over a few words to freely conversing was unanticipated. New words keep cropping up, though once he heard them two or three times, he didn't forget. Then there was the sheer necessity. He couldn't communicate for any purpose without the language. In spite of that incentive, the speed with which he was picking it up gave him pause. He knew he was smart. Science, mathematics, yes. Languages, no. Yet here, fewer than 3 months into intensive study, and he could carry on conversations and read simple texts. At first, two-way verbal communication was a multi-stage process with a mental English-Cadelli dictionary. A local would say something he would mentally translate, assemble the suspected correct Cadelli words, and pronounce them back. As time went on, mentally leaning on English faded. He still thought to himself and dreamed in English, but talking in Cadelli became easier day by day. He thanked God, or whomever, for the simple grammar. The rules were reasonably straightforward, with limited irregularities compared to the declensions, cases, and genders of Spanish and German. He wondered whether his progress was only because of necessity or from effects of whatever the Watchers did when they fiddled with his physiology to help him survive. Was he now smarter, or was his memory enhanced? He suspected memory, since he didn't feel smarter.
Thank you for coming, Joseph,
said the avuncular-sounding abbot as he welcomed Joseph.
Selmar and Brother Fitham tell me you've made amazing progress in learning Cadelli. Enough so that I'm anxious to learn more about you and your people.
The abbot waved to a pair of chairs facing each other, and they both sat.
And the medicans say you fully recovered from your ordeal.
The abbot continued inquiring into Joseph's condition and was oh so friendly and supportive sounding.
However, Josef never lost the feeling that the agenda was to determine whether he was a victim or a danger, a lost human, an enemy spy, or a demon of whatever pantheon of gods they had here.
Tell me, Josef, where is your home? The name of your people?
Best stick as close to the truth as possible, without telling the whole truth. The closer to the truth he stayed, the fewer inconsistencies would crop up later. Lying forced him to remember what story he told.
My people are Americans, and our country is called America.
America,
said Sistian, letting the syllables roll off his tongue.
America. I don't believe I have ever heard of America. Of course, I'm not well-traveled throughout the world. What continent is America on? Or is it more of an island like Cadellium?
It's on a continent, but we've had little contact with neighboring peoples. Though I don't understand why, I know I'd never met any other peoples of Anyar before I awoke here on Cadellium.
Well, thought Sistian, the world is wide. There were many lands he was sure he'd never heard of.
Still, it was unusual the man had never met anyone from outside his own people. Sistian reached behind himself and pulled a folded paper off a shelf. He laid it on the small table separating them and unfolded it several times to reveal a world map.
This is a map of Anyar. Can you show me where your land is?
Josef looked at the map, his eyes roving over the features of the planet. He'd seen Anyar from images of the globe Harley had shared with him. But the projection map made clearer the relationships of the major landmasses concentrated on half the globe. To the left of the map was an island with more prominent labeling than the other lands. Josef's Cadelli reading lessons let him recognize the name of the island, Cadellium. It was about half the size of Texas or Madagascar, maybe some hundreds of miles across. Selmar hadn't shown him any of this, so he wondered where Keelan lay.
I'm afraid I can't show you where my land is, Abbott. To be honest, this is the first complete map of Anyar I've ever seen.
Which was true, though of course it was the only map of the planet he'd ever seen. He didn't count the images of Anyar Harley had shown him.
I don't know why, but for some reason my people don't interact much with the other lands. All I can say is that the voyage here was long. I wasn't always fully conscious. So even that might be faulty memory. The climate also seemed similar to Cadellium, yet that could include much of the world.
Do you remember how you got here? On what ship and of what people?
No. I never saw those who took me from my homeland.
True.
They fed me, but I never left a small compartment or saw anyone.
True.
I don't understand why they took me or how I got from their ship to the beach near Abbotsford and the Abbey.
True. Or close enough. The abbot shook his head.
Too bad. We would all like to know more about you. How this happened to you. What about your family? What is their place among your people?
Josef paused. Was the abbot trying to pigeonhole him into a societal class? If he said the wrong thing, would it change how they treated him? Maybe they'd been so supportive of him out of being uncertain whether he belonged to a powerful family or clan. Josef decided to take a chance and continue saying things were different where he came from, yet not too different.
My father's a scholastic. One who studies the heavens and the stars.
Ah, an astrologer. One who predicts the future.
Not exactly. He studies the heavens
only by observing the moons, the planets, and the stars. It's called astronomy, and my father is an astronomer. In my land, we don't depend on predictions based on the heavens. Although they can sometimes come true, we believe such auguries are often too vague to serve as guidelines for our daily lives.
That was as close as Yosef thought he could come without debunking astrology.
Sistia nodded.
Something I agree with, although a few of my more conservative colleagues are not so sure.
Astrology was important to our people in the past, though not so much anymore, except for perhaps the common, less educated people. It's a belief not given credence by most of my brothers and sisters. So I find it interesting your people have come to the same conclusion.
Yosef saw an opening to both establish a rapport with the more educated locals and cover himself for the future.
Yes, it makes one consider that no matter where we are in the world, our peoples are coming to common understandings of God's realm.
Sistian frowned a little.
Well, now we're getting into theological areas we can discuss later.
Oops, thought Yosef. Maybe I reached a little too far on that one. Be careful.
And the rest of your family, are they all scholastics?
Not all. Many found different goals to their lives. Some soldiers, at least in grandfather's generation. Some theophists, I think Aunt Marcy's minister diploma from that mail-order outfit qualifies, at least as far as the Cadelli are concerned. Some leaders of our peoples. Uncle Fred was mayor of Castleton for one term before they realized he was spending more time bonking constituent wives than running the town. And Mom and Dad had stints as chairs of PTA chapters. And merchants and skilled tradesmen. Well, butcher at Safeway. And Cousin Bill's marijuana dispensary in San Francisco have to count. My people believe that God's plan for us is to do what each is best at and not be tied to a particular position or trade.
Sistian frowned, more puzzled than disapproving.
And how does your family know its proper place? It sounds chaotic. Does the family have no role?
Yosef formulated his next words carefully. From what he'd gathered so far in speaking with Carnegie and other staff, the family, the village, and the clan took care of its members and normally provided a role for them. This naturally meant limiting options. If you were the son of a blacksmith, chances were you'd also be a blacksmith, since by the age of 12, a boy would be helping his father. If a daughter, you'd learn the skills of being a mother and caring for a family, and in some circumstances, work in a family trade. Stepping out of those boundaries would be difficult. If your family members were tradesmen and you decided to be a farmer, you'd have to save enough money to buy your own farm. Your family would help if they were affluent enough, or you'd marry the daughter of a sonless farmer. And forget about moving to a different village or town. It was always a balance between limiting options and providing for livelihood. Yosef thought there were advantages to knowing your place. He wondered whether the United States was overall better. Yes, the options there were infinitely greater, but the downside was less family and community support. But how to answer the abbot? My people put great value on each person being responsible for his or her own success in life. While sometimes this means people don't have as much help from family and clan as you have here, they have more options for what to do with their lives. Now that I've seen the people of Cadellium, I'm not wise enough to say which is better, your system here or ours at my home.
Interesting. I'd like to speak with you more about this. As for your feeling, your own lack of wisdom, The word tells us that a path to wisdom is knowing you don't have it.
Yosef frowned.
The word?
The word of God,
Sistian stated.
Our main religious writing. It's usually shortened to the word in everyday speech.
Yosef nodded.
My people say a wise man knows he doesn't know, while a fool knows what isn't true.
Okay, maybe he couldn't exactly the quote, but who here would know?
Sistian smiled and nodded appreciatively.
Very true, and interestingly stated. I may even use those words someday in a God's Day message. And you yourself, Yosef. You mentioned you were a student. Forgive me, but for us, someone of your age who was still a student would be unusual, or the student not particularly bright. Certainly the latter doesn't apply to you. By your age, they would have finished their schooling and have a position based on their learnings.
He'd been waiting for the question. It was his chance for an opening to explain why he seemed to have so much exotic knowledge. No matter how careful he tried to be, it was only a matter of time before he began dropping pieces of that knowledge. He had to find a way around this, or it could have catastrophic consequences for him. Our land is blessed by God to be extraordinarily bountiful. We've more than enough food for all, and we send much of our bounty to a trading center where it is exchanged with other lands for their goods. Also, our hills and mountains are rich in gold and silver. All of this allows our people to spend more time considering the wonder of God's world in all its aspects. Many of the fields of study would probably seem trivial and pointless in Cadellium. Your land is productive, at least the parts I've seen, but still requires much effort and sweat to yield. Imagine if suddenly your people only had to work half as much time as they do now. What would they do with the rest of the time?
Sistian considered this novel idea for a few moments. I think it'd depend on each person. Many would simply take the time to do nothing. Sit and talk, engage in games, perhaps consume more alcohol. If they had both the extra time and money, you suggest. For myself, there are always people I wish I had more time to counsel. And I'd spend more time studying and considering the word.
What about your wife?
Dira? She'd spend more time with patients and studying medical books. She always worries she's forgotten some piece of knowledge or records of past treatments that she might find useful.
What if Dira had access to 10 times as many books and records?
I'm afraid she would try to drive herself to learn everything, no matter how much there was,